Wola wishes to thank the Samuel Rubin Foundation for the support that made this podcast possible. Welcome to Latin America Today, the Wola podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Adam Isaacson, a senior associate here at Wola.
And I'm Sarah Kenosian, a program officer.
This is the first in a series of three podcasts on Cuba. Cuba is an exciting historic moment right now. It's been in the process of change really for the past decade with gradual economic, social, and political reforms. These have accelerated in the past 2 or 3 years, and with renewed relations with the United States, the country seems to be past a tipping point for a change. The fact is that Cuba has a much different reality than it did just 10 years ago. And by 2026, the country will look very different than it does today. But how much has it changed? There's a lot going on, so we decided to parse it out into a few episodes. In this one, we're going to look at what's changed on the island. And in the following episodes, we'll look at access to information and openings for political debate, and then, finally, the role of U.S. policy.
Like the 1950s cars in Havana, the leaders and ideologies of Fidel Castro's communist revolution have aged. Meanwhile, the U.S. embargo has held. At the same time, something that has been evident to many Cubans for a while has become clear to many of those running the country. Parts of the system just aren't working, and Cuba's brand of socialism needs an update. When Raúl Castro took power from his older brother in 2008, he began to put the wheels of change slowly in motion. He opened up the economy to global markets. He relinquished state control, to some degree, over crucial sectors like tourism, agriculture, housing, and technology. He allowed for some private businesses and cooperatives, and he renewed relations with the United States. The country is in a period of enormous transformation, but there are several paths forward that the government could take. The big questions now are how the government will manage both this evolution and Cuba society's heightened expectations.
One of the biggest obstacles the Cuban government is facing seems to be reconciling its past and socialist identity with the present shift toward a more open society and economy. And although Raúl Castro has markedly changed how Cuba's government talks about the economy and market forces, this balancing act has produced mixed messages and results, sort of confusing. Mark Hansen, a senior associate with Wola's Cuba program, talks about this.
So Raúl Castro has made it clear that he intends to reform the economy. However, balancing that with the past and with the past of calling capitalist and capitalism the enemy and making sure that it's well known in Cuba that the free market is not the way they're going to organize their society, they're now in a situation where they are going to adapt their economy to include more market forces to try to create some dynamism. So while the reforms and the steps towards reform may be straightforward, how they talk about it and the rhetoric around the reforms may be a bit of a challenge.
Cuban officials' mantra on implementing reforms has been, without haste, but without pause. In 2011, the government announced a series of changes that gave Cubans access to more capital and information. This included allowing hundreds of thousands of people to register to work in the private sector, which as of December 2015 employed well over 500,000 people, around 11% of the workforce. More recent estimates put the unofficial number at 30% of the workforce. President Raúl Castro has said he wants it at an official 40%. Restrictions on travel abroad have been loosened, and Cubans can now live outside the country without giving up their residency, and many of them are the ones opening up businesses. Now Cubans can also legally purchase items that were previously off limits, such as microwaves, cars, and cell phones. They can access the internet from their cell phones at over 60 Wi-Fi spots, and there are plans in place to expand that number to 80. The daily number of internet users is over 150,000, more than twice what it was in 2014. While that is progress, still, just 1% of the population is able to get online, and even for those who can, access is extremely censored. Cubans can now buy, sell, and rent their homes in the private real estate market. Airbnb started operating in the country last year, and since then, 13,000 guests have stayed with Cuban hosts. It now has over 4,000 postings, up from 1,000 in 2015. The country's first wholesale food market was opened in 2013, and in the past 2 years, the government has given over 160,000 land titles to private farmers. Most farmland in Cuba is now held by agricultural cooperatives or individuals.
The Cuban government has also said it wants to attract $2 billion to $2.5 billion in new foreign direct investment. In 2014, a foreign investment law offered steep tax cuts for international investors. So far, five foreign companies have been approved to operate in the port of Mariel, thanks to a $1 billion project that was financed by the Brazilian development bank BNDES, which has modernized one of the island's most crucial ports and created a special economic zone. These reforms have extended into the social realm, too, with changes that have allowed for greater religious freedoms, a labor code that protects LGBTQ people, and more, albeit still pretty limited, allowance for political debate through traditional media platforms and blogs. We'll discuss this more in our next podcast. Before these changes, the highly regulated state structure and difficult economy forced Cubans to be creative and innovative within very tight constraints, using what little they had to find alternative sources of income, usually on the black market, to supplement their state salaries, which were woefully inadequate. But with these reforms and the new opportunities they bring, this entrepreneurial spirit and Cuba's highly educated workforce are ready for change.
And you have to choose your main course. It could be shrimps and lobster grill, calcio and beef, or lamb stew.
The tourism industry, places like bars, hotels, and private restaurants, has benefited the most under these reforms. Cuba received more than 3.5 million visitors last year, with nearly double the amount of U.S. tourists. For months, hotels have been at capacity and are now hiking up their prices. The Hotel Sevilla, a favorite hangout of Chicago gangster Al Capone in the 1930s, is booked through the year, and the cost of a room of a night there has increased 2.5 times, from $120 to $280. Tourism isn't expected to slow down anytime soon, especially as the loosened restrictions on U.S. travel and business take hold. Cruise companies like Carnival are now allowed to go through Cuba, and earlier this month, six U.S. airlines were approved to fly between the U.S. and five Cuban cities.
With this onslaught of new restaurants, business ventures, and tourism, the country's infrastructure really just hasn't been able to catch up. While hotels may be over capacity, after decades of neglect, they're crumbling. But the increase in visitors is pushing some much-needed updates. The three new hotels are currently under construction in Havana, and there are several bids to renovate some of the creaking structures that remain. The tourism boom has benefited business in Europe, China, and now slowly but surely the United States. Starwood Hotels and Resorts, which is Marriott, recently signed three hotel deals in Cuba, the first U.S. hotel company to do so in 60 years. Tourism is probably the most dynamic part of Cuba's small but growing private sector. As of right now, people can work in tourism, be it working as a tour guide, renting out their homes, opening their own restaurants. Doing so, they can bring home $300 a month, which is better than working on state salaries and bringing in $25 a month. Not that anyone actually lives off state salaries. If they're not doing it in tourism, they all bolster their income with black market side hustles. Most self-employed Cubans work in the service sector, in bars, restaurants, beauty parlors, or mechanic shops, whether it's tourism or not. This is Edgar. Edgar has run a restaurant outside Havana for 3 years, and he loves it. Before the interview, he spent about 40 minutes telling Wola about all his different business ideas, mostly in the service industry, other restaurants, bars, etc.
But now, this is good. Like private business, you make. Actually, I have, I don't know if it's the Cuban government is going to hear this, but no, because if they hear it, they're going to charge me. I have 20 workers, and I'm feeding 20 families. And we feel like family now. We are a big family, and they're getting a lot of money.
How many of the workers have you had from the very beginning, when you started this place 3 years ago?
I have six already. I had 12 workers from the beginning. I have six, but I have now 20, 23. Yeah. I have a lot of new workers.
Private enterprise in a state-run economy has its struggles. While Edgar told our group that he buys his vegetables fresh from the markets, he told us afterwards that most of the food that he actually buys has been stolen from hotels. And this black market food system doesn't appear to be going away anytime soon. That wholesale market we mentioned before, the government just shut it down without explanation. Edgar describes some of the other challenges to doing business in Cuba.
And we need a lot of things. We need, I don't know if I said it right in English, but it's... wholesale, can be?
Yep.
Wholesale market, we don't have it. We have to buy things from the stores like regular people. And that's why some of the prices for Cubans are a little bit high. We need to commercialize the business. We don't have the places to make like I don't know how to say it in English. You help with propaganda.
Yeah, advertising.
Advertising and let's say okay, there is a restaurant in the center of Matanzas. We don't have a place to stay. That but internet that we have we find a way to get into internet in Facebook and these things. We try to have a website, but we cannot because for websites you have to pay the websites. We don't have the way to pay websites in Cuba. That's why we don't have any Facebook and TripAdvisor and things like that.
So as you can see, the large, centralized, tightly controlled, bureaucratic Cuban state has been slow to process these reforms and make the needed changes to allow for market forces in a highly controlled economy. While we were there, other entrepreneurs also mentioned harassment from government officials. They mentioned supply shortages. They mentioned limited and expensive internet. Mark Hansen talks about why we haven't seen some of the changes that many Cubans would like to see.
As the Cuban government is struggling with how to talk about reforms, the real question is, how does the Cuban public receive these dictates, and will they do they trust that the Cuban government will stay on this track towards reform? And I think the early indications are that, in fact, the Cuban people are investing their own money in their own businesses. But they're limited as far as how they can grow them and access to capital and access to different goods and services. And so the Cuban government is sort of failed to take the next step along the lines of reform and really deepen the reforms, because it appears that they are struggling, reconciling where they want to go and where they've been in the past, and then how they create a future that maintains a little bit of the social solidarity that they've built over the past 50 years and blends that with a more individualistic model for the economy.
Mark went on to talk about these divisions within Cuba's Communist Party between hardliners and reformers.
It's not the case that the Cuban government is monolithic. There are individuals, there are people who run that government, some of which might see a big, robust, forward-leaning reform agenda as the thing that should be pursued, and that even if there are some costs to social development, they should pursue it. Others might be kind of middle of the road, wanting some reforms, but trying to mediate some of these social costs that come with the reforms. And then other people who want to just keep it exactly as it has been. Because for whatever reason, either they are nervous about what reforms mean or that they're benefiting with the current system. And so I think within the Cuban government, you've got an ongoing debate about how quickly to reform. And on some days, reformers are up, and on other days, some of the more conservative status quo folks are up.
We also spoke to Bill Leogrand, an expert on Cuba and a professor at American University. Bill co-wrote the recent book, Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana.
Well, I think there's no doubt that there are some people in the Cuban leadership who are anxious about allowing broader political debate. We know that there's a lot of discontent in Cuba because of the economic situation. Raul Castro himself has acknowledged that in various speeches. We see it in the handful of public opinion polls that have been done on the island that show a lot of discontent, especially around the economy. And we see it in the large number of people, particularly young people, who want to leave and make a life somewhere else. So given that level of underlying discontent, and also some of the social disruption that comes with the economic changes that are underway, it's no surprise that there are some people in the government and in the Communist Party that are worried that this discontent could boil over into political opposition if they open up the political scene a little too much.
This discourse was evident at Cuba's Communist Party Congress this past April. What is this? Every 5 years, this is a meeting that sets the country's economic and political agenda. And this year, Raul Castro got up and criticized the slow pace of reforms. He blamed an obsolete mentality and attitude of inertia, his words, for the lack of progress. In contrast, Fidel Castro later appeared in front of the same Congress, where he called for it to uphold the ideals of the 1959 revolution, and he criticized President Obama's visit. The overall somewhat contradictory message that came out of all that was, let's change, but also let's do more of the same. There was a lot of excitement leading up to this party Congress. After 5 years of economic reforms, the reopening of new relations with the United States, President Obama's visit, people were expecting some real change. But then the Communist Party essentially came out and said, let's put the brakes on more reform and keep moving forward with the changes that we already committed to. The Cuban government has said it has implemented just 21%, or 66 of the 313 reform proposals that came from the last Congress 5 years ago. Normally, there's public discussion about the party Congress's agenda, but this year it was all in secret. Julio Guanche, a lawyer and political scientist with the relatively new group Cuba Posible, explains why.
This means that, after several years, the process is going very slowly, and the pace is unsatisfactory even for its very organizers. In terms of economic growth, this year, a 2% growth rate is expected. This is a much lower rate than is needed, and that would be expected of a reform that places so much emphasis on growing the economy. It has relegated income distribution to a lower priority, with the thinking that economic growth was the higher priority. But growth has become very complicated and the redistribution mechanism ineffective. That's one reason why they didn't bring it up to public debate again, because they have little to offer. Maybe it wasn't convenient for the architects of those reforms to have a process that would make these shortcomings more visible.
Mark explains how splits in the government around reforms has produced a confusing dynamic on the island.
So the somewhat stilted process of reforms, where you have reform-minded leaders getting out and talking about the next steps in the reform process, followed on by more hardliners talking about how they're going to stay true to the revolution, sometimes creates some confusion on the ground. But more than just confusion on the ground, we actually see it in the material lives of how Cubans, and particularly young Cubans, are living. Some young Cubans are deciding to exit. They're leaving Cuba in record numbers. They've decided that the reforms aren't going to proceed fast enough because they're not getting clarity about where those reforms are going, while other Cubans are returning to Cuba and sending money to Cuba to invest in businesses. So at the same time, we have reflected in the material lives of people investment and exit. We have a dynamic in the political elite that's equally confused, which is to have some reformers out talking one day and the next day a set of hardliners, and that continues to happen. And so I think what's clear is that very little in Cuba is clear right now, and what we're going to have to do is watch what actually happens rather than what's said.
But things are moving. Since the Party Congress in April, the government has announced that it would move to legalize thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Tourism continues to climb, and relations with the United States continue to progress with ongoing negotiations, delegations, and cultural exchanges. This momentum is driving expectations higher, says Bo Leogrand.
Well, there's no question that people have very high expectations of the improvement of relations with the United States, and also of the economic reform process. People are really hoping that this is going to finally provide significant improvements in their standard of living. It hasn't yet, and so some people are beginning to be a little disappointed by the reform process. And I think one of the challenges the government faces is actually being able to raise the standard of living of the general majority of the population sometime in the relatively near future, or people may lose faith in this reform process.
And it seems like some people are already losing faith, especially young people. Managing expectations is hard. Life is still tough for the average Cuban, and for the middle class, the doctors, the engineers whose careers are tied to the state, many of them are making less than taxi drivers and those working in tourism. We talked to Enrique, a 27-year-old Cuban student currently living in Washington, D.C., about how he views the changes. He'll be returning to Cuba in the next few months to resume work within the Ministry of Culture.
For example, with regard to private businesses, what's going on? People think, oh, okay, they're incentivizing private businesses. But when you look for all the private businesses that are opening in Cuba, it turns out to be a very basic sector. It's impossible to have a big change in Cuba when private businesses are only restaurants, barbershops, or something like that. Because no matter how good your restaurant is, no matter how good your barbershop is, it will never be good enough to make you rich or to have enough money to invest elsewhere or earn enough. It will give you enough money to make a living. So what happens is that in Cuba you live on very little. That person who works in a restaurant, in theory, might
earn, I don't know, maybe $2,000 or $3,000. That's some money, but it's not so much that you'll say, okay, I'm a different person now. I'm a person who earns profits from this. I don't believe it's a real change.
We asked him what he thought would bring real change.
If there is going to be more or less of a relatively large change, there must be two things. One, that there be investments in Cuba's most important sectors. The most important sectors would be industry, biotechnology, even education and cultural exchange projects. The second thing is that Cubans must be able to come and go freely in order to see other places. For instance, the type of relationship that exists between the United States and Cuba doesn't allow, or doesn't easily allow, Cubans to come to the United States and see how it functions. Not that the U.S. model should be copied, but at least that people can see it and draw their own conclusions.
Enrique went on to say that the reason he was excited about renewing relations with the United States was that it would bring the kind of investments in the sectors that he thinks Cuba needs. Now, there are big economic changes going on in the country, as we've seen. For this first time, many people in Cuba have access to much more capital than they did before. But as you can also see, with all this ambiguity surrounding the reform process, the pace of reform, the direction of the country in general, some people, especially the younger generation, still don't see a future in the country. We'll touch on migration in a different episode, but it is worth noting that Cubans are fleeing in droves right now. According to the Homeland Security Department, at least as of March, for the first 6 months of the fiscal year that started in October, migration from Cuba across the U.S.-Mexico border was up 84%. If that rate holds all year, it will mean that almost about one in every 140 Cubans will leave Cuba, go through Mexico, and cross the land border just this year. This in part has to do with U.S. migration policy, the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, but in part it also has to do with Cuba's economy.
Cuba knows it has to change. The leftist allies it has been relying on for financial and political support are in crisis. Lula and Dilma in Brazil are gone. Hugo Chavez is gone. The Kirchners in Argentina are gone. Oil shipments from Venezuela are greatly reduced. Brazil, under new right-leaning leadership, isn't offering the same kind of political support. Cuba's leaders are finding that the country needs to go out and find foreign direct investment. To do so, it needs to figure out creative ways to inspire growth and create opportunities for young people. Right now, some of the reforms in place might make that happen. The question will be, are they able to implement them fast enough for their economy to thrive? At this moment, what would be a true game changer in the Cuban economy and help bring that investment so necessary to reform would be a lifting of the 55-year-old U.S. embargo.
And right now, there are dynamics going on in Congress that might lead to that happening sooner rather than later. Maybe, maybe not, but we'll leave that for another episode. For now, thank you for tuning in to the WOLA Latin America Today podcast. Next week, we will post another segment on Cuba discussing the debate over political reforms on the island.